to go. Hey, hey, ho, ho. These killer cops have got to go. Hey, hey.
I'm here to march for justice. Hell, I marched with Martin Luther King August the 28th, 1966. I was 10 years old. I'm here to try to keep my great nephews and grandkids alive. Because right now, the way it's going right here in South Shore, they're dying in leaps and bounds.
It's been 3 days since the police shooting of Harith Augustus, a barber on Chicago's South Side, and there have been protests and clashes with police every night since. Harith Augustus is the third person killed by police in Chicago so far this year. On Sunday, Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson released a 40-second video clip of the shooting and urged protesters to trust the investigation.
I know everybody is emotionally heightened. I get that. But at the same time, we have a process in place. And if we have to hold individuals accountable, we will. Don't judge things on your emotion. Let the facts guide your decision on what you think.
Despite the superintendent's press conference, hundreds of Chicago residents turned out on Monday to protest on the block where Augustus was killed. Here's Roberta Wood, who's lived in Chicago's South Shore neighborhood for 40 years, speaking with WBEZ at the protest.
Well, I think that the police have to be accountable. I think that they have to be trained not to shoot first and ask questions later. They have to be trained not to accost people because they're black or brown. You know, I hold this, the leadership of the city is responsible. It's their department. They got to do something about it.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we begin today in the city of Chicago, where Patrick Smith has been following the shooting and its aftermath. He covers criminal justice for member station WBEZ Chicago. Patrick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about some of the facts of the case for some of our listeners who may not be familiar. What do we know so far about Harith Augustus, and what can you tell us about the moments that led up to his death?
Well, we know that he was a 37-year-old barber who lived in the South Shore neighborhood just a few blocks from where he was killed. He was, you know, by reports, well-liked in the community, well-known. You know, as a barber, he cut a lot of people's hair who lived in South Shore. And he was out on a main thoroughfare on Saturday evening when police stopped him. The reason they gave for stopping him was language I've actually never heard them use before. They said that he demonstrated the characteristics of having a weapon. So they stopped him for that. And in the video that you mentioned, you can see he's talking to one officer and actually has pulled out his wallet, seems to be showing his ID to the officer, when another pair of officers come up on him and one grabs him by the wrist. He sort of yanks himself free and turns. And in that video that was released, you can see that he has a gun on his right hip. And as he turns to run away, he grabs at his hip. And at some point during all that motion, one of the officers starts firing. This was body cam footage that was released. It is silent, so it's impossible to tell when the first shot is fired. But he was killed in that incident.
Now, the preliminary results of the autopsy were released on Sunday. What do we know so far?
Well, we know that he was killed by multiple gunshot wounds, and the medical examiner has ruled it a homicide, although that's obviously not a judgment call. It's just a simple fact. What we will know when the full autopsy is out is how many bullets hit him and where they hit him, which is one of many things that the community is still trying to find out about the shooting.
And we saw overnight on Saturday that some protesters reportedly threw rocks and bottles of urine at police, and in some cases, police fought back. I want to play a clip from an activist who was on the scene that day.
Unarmed black women. I watched women beg Chicago police officers not to hit them. And I watched Chicago police officers hit them with batons. Chicago Police Department is not fixed, and that has to be noted.
Are you seeing more of that mood, Patrick, as the days go on?
Well, I think what you have heard is a focus on the way the police acted in the protest after that. You know, there's been some focus on this shooting. There's been some talk just about sort of broader police reform issues and some focus on how police interacted with protesters. You had this situation where, you know, it's a busy Saturday evening in Chicago. Police shoot somebody and it draws a crowd in. And so you get a lot of residents who might not otherwise have gone to a police protest who are involved. And then a bunch of, you know, the sort of usual faces you see at police protests. One thing that might have you know, sort of made this more of a clash than you see at other protests is the fact that, you know, they were centered around an active crime scene and crime scene that the police needed to preserve, which is why you didn't have the option of the police sort of letting the protesters go wherever they wanted to. That I'm not saying that justifies whatever the police may or may not have done in that instance, but that created a different dynamic than you get at other protests where there was a very specific area that police were sort of centered at and they didn't really have the option of leaving or trying to appease the crowd.
We know, of course, that the Laquan McDonald killing 4 years ago. After that, the U.S. Department of Justice released a pretty intense report criticizing the Chicago police for the force that was used on Black and Latino residents of the city. Is the release of the body cam footage in this case and potentially other moves that the police department might make, the call for calm, are those in reaction to changes in the Chicago PD as a result of the Laquan McDonald case?
Well, not really. The release of this video did not follow the protocol that was set up as part of those reform efforts. They released just this one 40-second clip of silent body camera footage that shows the gun to try to sort of keep the peace, but it didn't follow the typical pattern that we get here. You know, usually it's about 2 months before they release any video or audio. And one thing that protesters and lots of people have been saying is how can you release just this one out of context clip and not release anything else? We're still waiting on all the rest of the information.
Patrick Smith covers criminal justice for WBEZ in Chicago. Patrick, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
We want it to be done swiftly. We don't want politics to play a part in this. We just want justice for my son, Eric.
That's Gwen Carr, whose son, Eric Garner, was killed by police in Staten Island after being put into a chokehold for selling untaxed cigarettes. On Monday afternoon, 4 years after Garner was killed, the New York Police Department announced it would move forward with internal disciplinary proceedings against two of the officers involved in Garner's death. It's a step towards accountability for the family and for the Black Lives Matter movement, which emerged at the center of the fight for justice for Garner. Erica Garner, Eric's daughter, largely led that fight from within Black Lives Matter until she died suddenly last December. Patrice Cullors is co-founder of Black Lives Matter, and she joins me now to talk about the movement for social and racial justice in the 5 years since founding the organization in July 2013. Patrice, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So it's been 5 years. I almost can't believe it, that much time has passed. How do you feel looking back at 5 years of this movement?
I feel grateful. I also feel like we have a long ways to go. I feel like Black Lives Matter offered an opportunity for Black communities, especially those of our communities who are poor. Those are communities who have been impacted by the everyday policing, to stand up and fight back and to say enough is enough. And I think we've accomplished so much of that.
Let's talk a little bit. In the introduction, we talked about Eric Garner's death and that we are seeing some disciplinary action come, but it's coming 4 years after Eric Garner's death. And we're also seeing the case evolving in Chicago over the past couple of days. Are these things indicators that Black Lives Matter generally has had an impact, or is there much more that needs to be done?
I think it's both. The fact that even 4 years later, this case is still an issue has everything to do with the people on the ground in New York and across the country and across the world who said justice for Eric Garner. The fact that there are folks in the streets of Chicago, really led by BYP 100, Charlene Carruthers, who's the co-founder and also the national director of that organization, her and her members are out in the streets. And it's important that we have kept ourselves alive even when the entire, administration, Trump administration, has been receiving all the media coverage.
Now, of course, 5 years ago, I'd love if you could tell us a little bit about what you and Opal Tometi and Alicia Garza, who were the three women who really came up with the hashtag Black Lives Matter, what was happening at that moment? I think this happened in the shadow, sadly, of the Trayvon Martin killing, and then we had Ferguson, right?
That's exactly right. In 2013, when George Zimmerman was acquitted of Trayvon Martin's death, I was in shock. Many of us were. We believed some sort of justice was going to happen, but instead, George Zimmerman got to go home. And I didn't want that to be the period of the story. Alicia Garza said Black Lives Matter. I put a hashtag on it, and Opal Tometi joined us. and developing out what would then become this generation's call to action.
And, you know, there are some folks who say, well, it's been Black Lives Matter, has lost some of its urgency or some of its impact. There were some reports about a year and change ago that said that there was some infighting in the movement. You know, how do you see the development of this movement, which doesn't have, so some of our listeners know, doesn't have a central office? It's not sort of centrally located in one place. So how do you see the development of Black activism, I guess, more broadly with this moniker of Black Lives Matter? Is it losing traction? Is it evolving into something different?
I think that's a great question. One, it's every good movement, every good organization evolves. It doesn't stay the same. The people in it don't stay the same. And so Black Lives Matter has gone from, you know, a phrase to a hashtag to a protest movement. We're also an organization of 40 chapters, not just in the United States, but in Canada and the United Kingdom. Black Lives Matter is looking at how do we take on elected officials? How do some of us become elected officials? Black Lives Matter is looking at fighting for legislation. And we're also we also understand that protest is absolutely important and necessary when it comes to fighting for democracy.
And of course, we're also in a moment of large-scale protests, not just in Black Lives Matter, but we saw this at the Women's March. We're seeing this now with the crisis at the southern border. There are rallies for immigration. I mean, there are Americans are really exercising their right to protest. Do you think the Black Lives Matter protest in particular had a role in shaping this new wave of activism we're seeing in the United States?
Most definitely. Black Lives Matter set the foundation for how we fight in this generation, for whether it's the Women's March or Me Too, or the fight to keep families together. This movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, set the tone for generations to come.
Patrice Cullors is the co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement. Patrice, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I think that the probe is a disaster for our country. I think it's kept us apart. It's kept us separated. There was no collusion at all. Everybody knows it.
The probe. That was President Trump in his joint press conference with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Monday. He's, of course, referring to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 election. So far, 32 people have been charged in connection with the investigation, including 12 Russians just last Friday. When asked outright about possible extradition of those 12 individuals, President Trump deflected. The press conference only heightened questions and speculation about the progress of Mueller's investigation. But Garrett Graff, a contributing editor for Wired and the author of The Threat Matrix Inside Robert Mueller's FBI, says there are things we can learn from what Mueller has done publicly in order to better understand where this probe might be headed next.
We talk about the Mueller probe as if it's one thing, but probably the best way to think about it is as five separate investigations in one. There's a bucket of investigations that Mueller is leading that's focused on money laundering and past business deals. That's where he's charged Paul Manafort and Rick Gates. Then there's a part of the investigation that focuses on Russian information influence operations. That's where he's charged the Internet Research Agency. Then there's a separate line of investigation that focuses on the active cyber penetrations by Russian intelligence. That's where we saw Friday's indictment against the Russian intelligence service, GRU. And then there's a fourth category that is what I would sort of describe as sketchy campaign contacts. That's where we've seen the charges against Michael Flynn and George Papadopoulos for their contacts with Russian officials during the campaign and during the transition. And then sort of there's the fifth area, which is obstruction of justice. And that's, you know, the president's role in obstructing the preceding four investigations into the Russian attack on the 2016 election.
The special counsel's office actually declined to comment on yesterday's Putin and Trump summit in Helsinki. But I'm wondering if any of what was said, based on your analysis of what Mueller's done so far, could be used to strengthen any of these five areas that Mueller's currently investigating.
It's hard to say. One of the most interesting questions for the investigation coming out of the press conference is we've seen former CIA Director John Brennan and former Director of National Intelligence Jim Clapper say that the U.S. has evidence that Vladimir Putin was personally involved and approved these attacks. So part of the question coming out of the press conference yesterday is, what is that evidence, and are we going to see that become public? Will the president's denials and statement that he believes Putin over the FBI and the intelligence community hasten that information, that evidence of Putin's personal involvement in this attack becoming public?
And we also, you mentioned earlier when we were talking about the five different areas here, we know that some former Trump campaign officials are, in fact, cooperating with Mueller, including Michael Flynn, as you mentioned. Do we know whether or not any information that they've had has played into this, any of the charges that we've seen announced so far?
Yeah, this to me is one of the most interesting questions of the investigation as it's unfolding right now, which is that we know that George Papadopoulos, Michael Flynn, and Rick Gates have all cooperated with Mueller's investigation. And we know from the plea deals that they took that they actually traded important information for lenience in their own cases. And we have no reason to believe that any of that information from Papadopoulos, Flynn, or Gates has become public. And that to me says that some of the biggest steps are still ahead of us, which is, this is information that Mueller thought was deeply critical and important to his investigation, that he was willing to trade pretty significant jail time in some of these cases with Papadopoulos, Flynn, and Gates in order to have become part of his investigation. And so we haven't seen that become public. And that's one of the most important pieces of information that we know, that Mueller knows, that we don't know.
We're talking Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, and Garrett Graff is with me. Garrett, is there anything that suggests that Mueller is looking into whether Russian money might have influenced the 2016 elections?
Yeah, and that's one, we don't know exactly where this investigation is going to go and who it will eventually wrap up. But what we do know is that there are very significant lines of inquiry that Mueller has shown a longstanding investigative interest in that have not become public in any way. And one of those is, as you said, where Russian money has come and gone. Even actually this week, we saw the arrest in D.C. of Maria Butina, a Russian national charged with conspiracy to be an unregistered foreign agent of the Russian Federation, which is government speak for a Russian spy. And one of the things that appears that she's very much involved in was helping to build relationships between the GOP and the NRA and Russia. And we know that Mueller has been interested in the way that money has flowed potentially from Russians into the 2016 campaign and potentially to the NRA as part of its pro-Trump election spending in 2016.
And we recently saw Trey Gowdy at a congressional hearing recently get very upset about the timeline of this investigation. Do we have a sense of when Mueller might be looking to close this investigation?
We don't. This is sort of hard for, I think, a lot of people who don't follow federal investigations closely to realize. But Mueller's team is actually moving very rapidly for a federal investigation. You know, federal investigations are long, slow, in-depth, thorough processes. And that for Mueller to have done all that he has in really sort of 13 or 14 months at this point is a remarkable speed and agility. You know, many times when you see these investigations go on, you know, they can take 3, 4, 5 years. And sort of one of the ironies of Trey Gowdy complaining about investigations is that he was the one who led the congressional Benghazi investigation that lasted, you know, 3 or 4 times as long as Mueller's probe has lasted and brought no criminal charges whatsoever. Whereas Mueller, you know, barely a year into this has brought nearly 200 criminal charges at this point.
Garrett Graff from Wired had one more take on the ongoing Mueller probe. He said Monday's comment by Vladimir Putin saying he wanted Donald Trump to become president backed up information the U.S. intelligence community has outlined before.
Remember that sort of what we are learning so far is that it appears that there were multiple stages of this Russian attack, that it didn't necessarily start out as a way to help Donald Trump, because that was seen as such a long shot in 2015 and early 2016. And so it began really as an attack on the Democrats, as a way to undermine Hillary Clinton and to undermine Americans' confidence in their own electoral system. From there, though, over the course of the spring and particularly into the summer and the fall, you did see, according to what we know publicly, a marked change in the Russian attack to not just be an anti-Clinton effort, to be a pro-Trump effort. And certainly Mueller's indictment on Friday begins to outline some of that increased operational tempo that we saw by the Russian intelligence services in June, July of 2016. And so that is where you really do see that Russian preference for Donald Trump begin to kick in. Remember, that happens to overlap, and we don't know whether there's a significance to this right now, but that happens to overlap with the period where there was that infamous Trump Tower meeting with Don Jr., Paul Manafort, Jared Kushner, and some Russian Kremlin-connected officials.
That, again, is Garrett Graff, a contributing editor for Wired and the author of The Threat Matrix, Inside Robert Mueller's FBI. And following yesterday's press conference with President Trump and President Putin in Helsinki, there's been a wave of backlash from both Democrats and Republicans. Former CIA Director John Brennan tweeted, quote, "Donald Trump's press conference performance in Helsinki rises to and exceeds the threshold of high crimes and misdemeanors. It was nothing short of treasonous. Not only were Trump's comments imbecilic, he is wholly in the pocket of Putin. Republican patriots, where are you?" Senator John McCain called it, quote, "disgraceful," and Senator Bob Corker said he was, quote, "disappointed." Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told reporters that the Russians, quote, "are not our friends, and I entirely agree with the assessment of our intelligence community." Neil Cavuto, a host on Fox News, also had strong words.
"That's what made his performance disgusting. I'm sorry, it's just the only way I feel. It's not a right or left thing to me, it's just wrong. A U.S. president on foreign soil talking to our biggest enemy or adversary or competitor, I don't know how we define them these days, is essentially letting the guy get away with this."
And here's former U.S. ambassador to Russia, William J. Burns.
"I mean, I think that press conference was the single most embarrassing performance by an American president on the world stage that I've ever seen anyway."
One defender, Vice President Mike Pence.
"Truth is, over the last week, the world saw once again the President Donald Trump stands without apology as leader of the free world."
President Trump appeared on Fox News last night at an interview with Sean Hannity where he doubled down on his belief that Russia wasn't involved in election interference.
"One thing you know, if they had it, it would have been out.
He said it was nonsense.
He said it's nonsense, is right. And he also said there's absolutely no collusion, which you know, and everybody that watches your show knows. And I think most of the country knows. And Tucker, standing right over there, definitely knows because he gets it. He's one of the people that get it."
And what about you? Do you get it?
"Hi, this is Kathy from Logan, Ohio. I am stunned and appalled. Very, very undemocratic. It is almost veering, and I've never said this, on treason."
"This is Donna Kalim in San Francisco. I'm terrified by the possibility of a Trump-Putin world. Uppermost on Trump's mind was that the United States and Russia have 90% of the world's nukes. What a peaceful mindset. It appears that little Putin has gullible tied down.
I'm calling from St. Paul, Minnesota. It's very obvious to me that he's using the whole Russian thing and this conversation as a platform to once again say that there is no collusion, and that is what he's doing. And that's what he's using it for, and it's a totally personal thing. It has nothing to do with a lot of the other things that people are trying to analyze.
Hi, my name is Theodore Corwin from Costa Mesa, California. It's really time for the American right to rethink itself and rehumanize itself.
We want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tomorrow, Nelson Mandela would have turned 100. And today, South Africa celebrates the anti-apartheid leader with a series of celebrations and speakers headlined by former President Barack Obama.
Madiba's light shone so brightly, even from that narrow Robben Island cell, that in the late 70s, he could inspire a young college student on the other side of the world to re-examine his own priorities, could make me consider the small role I might play in bending the arc of the world towards justice.
That's the former president speaking before thousands of South Africans earlier today in one of his most highly publicized appearances since leaving office. Milton Nkosi is a correspondent for the BBC in Johannesburg covering the 16th annual Nelson Mandela Lecture, and he joins me now. Milton, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with you, Tanzina.
So that was a stirring and I guess typically long speech for President Obama. What was the overall reaction in the crowd?
The reaction in the crowd was of excitement, hope, inspiration, just as you would expect a speech by Barack Obama when it's delivered. He is indeed a great orator, and he was received warmly by South Africans, both at the stadium where I was and across the country where people were following on television and on radio.
Now, a lot of the speech was focused on this fight for democracy and for equality. How did Obama use the voice of Mandela to tell people where they should be focusing their efforts?
Yes, he was very eloquent, as usual. He quoted from many quotes which were delivered by Nelson Mandela. It was quite powerful because South Africans have followed Nelson Mandela's story for many years now. Remember, he's their liberator from racial oppression. So when President Obama today connected the dots of Nelson Mandela's story and intertwined it with what is happening today, that was well received by the audience.
And not only did he intertwine it with what's happening today, I felt watching some of the parts of the speech that it felt very directed also at our current president, President Trump, and at protecting democracies across the world.
And as with the denial of rights, the denial of facts runs counter to democracy. It could be its undoing.
Yes, indeed. He was very clear. And to be honest, certainly in my mind, and I know to the minds of many who were sitting all around me, they did think about the whole fake news phenomena that comes from particularly from America when people are watching television. Mr. Obama was very clear. He said, you have to believe in facts.
You have to believe in facts. Without facts, there's no basis for cooperation.
And you can be rest assured that as he was talking there, we all had in our minds the face of Nelson Mandela, the liberator of South Africa. But at the same time, we had the face of those who were challenging facts on a daily basis on our social media screens and on television. And he said that it was very strange that what Nelson Mandela said when he left prison in 1990 on February the 11th, that he came out of prison and he told us about the fact that we share a common humanity. And he said it was strange that today in 2018, after all those years Nelson Mandela left prison, me, Barack Obama, as he said to us, have to still make space in my lecture to remind you that we are all human after all.
We are all human, that our differences are superficial, and that we should treat each other with care and respect. I would have thought we would have figured that out by now. I thought that basic notion was well established.
And remember, you're addressing an audience about a person they know slightly more than average, because Nelson Mandela was a leader for the South African anti-apartheid struggle for over six decades. So people knew the person Barack Obama was talking about today, but he said it in such a way that it connected very smoothly without any bumps at all.
Milton Cozzi is a correspondent for the BBC in Johannesburg. Milton, thanks for this update.
You're much welcome.
Dennis Kruiwagen is a South African journalist and political commentator, as well as a former parliamentary spokesperson for the African National Congress, who knew Nelson Mandela, and he joins me now. Dennis, thanks for being with us.
It is a great pleasure.
So it's been 5 years since the death of Nelson Mandela. When you look at South Africa today, where do you think the country is? And in these 5 years, where has it gotten?
I think we've got a bit lost in the 5 years since Mandela died. We had an aberration of a president called Jacob Zuma. Under his watch, corruption, oh my goodness, corruption thrived in our country. We had a phenomenon down here which was known as state capture, which basically meant that a few individuals were hollowing out state-owned entities and lining their own pockets. So reconciliation in South Africa, Mandela was a champion of racial reconciliation. That too has taken a knock. So I think we've got to regain our bearings and get back on the road that Mandela wanted us to follow.
And I definitely want to talk about political independence and specifically the right to vote. In 1994, after the collapse of the apartheid system, 9 out of 10 South Africans went to the polls that year. But are we seeing similar rates of participation today?
Sadly, no. The number of South Africans, total number, who have gone to the polls to vote or either to register to be eligible to vote, that has dropped remarkably. And I think I would describe that to disenchantment with the African National Congress, because in 2016 we had what we call local government elections, and the ANC suffered a bloody nose at the polls, and they lost control of most of our major cities, including a significant one called Nelson Mandela Metro, which is in the province of the Eastern Cape where Mandela was born. So coming from there, from the roots, so to speak, Mandela's roots, shows that voters have grown disenchanted with the ANC and they want change. And also there was this huge specter of corruption that accompanied the Zuma administration, and also an arrogance of being in power that the ANC displayed, an arrogance of taking the voters for granted. And I dare say they paid a huge price.
Why is it, or has Mandela's legacy been guarded up until this point? And if so, why is it so crucial?
I think Mandela's legacy is so crucial because he spoke about racial reconciliation between all South Africans. He spoke about everyone having a home in the South African sun, but he also spoke against staying on a journey of vengeance and exacting revenge on those who had governed the country before, those being the whites of this particular country. So that message was so important in keeping us together. There are those in the EFF who have said Mandela has sold out the country and he bent over backwards to accommodate whites and white fears and white interests. And while one hears that and understands that, it also shows a bit of naivety, because the world has changed. When Mandela came from prison, he thought he could nationalize left, right, and center until he went to the World Economic Forum in Davos, and where he realized the world has changed. So, yes, we need to return to a nation that is reconciled, a nation that has a common goal, and we need to do that. And I think Cyril Ramaphosa could be the answer to that.
Dennis Kruiwagen is a South African journalist and political commentator, as well as a former parliamentary spokesperson for the African National Council and former acquaintance of Nelson Mandela. Dennis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Have a lovely day.
Nelson Mandela, bring him back home to Soweto. I want to see him walking down the streets of South Africa. Hey! Tomorrow! Bring back Nelson Mandela, bring him back home to Soweto. I want to see him walking hand in hand with Winnie Mandela. I had a number of passports.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and I got a question for you. How do you define American food?
Typically, we think about, you know, the hot dogs, the hamburgers, the barbecue, pizza. And, you know, my mission, I guess, has always been to let's expand that definition.
That's chef and writer Edward Lee. And all this week on The Takeaway, we're exploring food in the United States. And Lee, born to South Korean immigrant parents in Brooklyn, who now owns restaurants in Kentucky and Maryland, has spent a lot of time thinking about what American food really is. In fact, he spent 2 years traveling across the United States, meeting people and eating food that makes up most of our nation's culinary landscape.
To me, American food is the luxury of diversity. You know, what we have in this country is something so precious. I can wake up, have a Jewish breakfast, have an Indian lunch, and have a Mexican dinner. You don't get that in very many countries around the world.
Lee's new book is called Buttermilk Graffiti, A Chef's Journey to Discover America's New Melting Pot Cuisine. And I asked him how he came to take this cross-country journey and what he found along the way.
So, you know, I grew up in a neighborhood near Canarsie, Brooklyn, which was very diverse, right? Jamaicans and Indians, but also Italians and Polish. And I just grew up eating international food, not thinking anything of it. It was just, that's just what you ate. I thought the whole world was like that. And I had a restaurant in New York City when I was in my early 20s, and 9/11 happened. And it forced me to sort of look at things very differently. And I lost my restaurant. And for the first time, I thought, you know what? I could actually go out and discover this thing called America, which I had never really knew about. Because growing up in New York or in Brooklyn is not typical America. So I went on these different road trips. And lo and behold, I ended up in Louisville, Kentucky. I drank some bourbon. And I decided to make it home for the next 16 years. So I started to eat country ham and biscuits and gravy and fried chicken and collard greens and all these wonderful foods of the American South that had such a long and twisted history, a very complex cuisine. And I started to go, well, I love collards, but I kind of want to add kimchi to it. And I love barbecue sauce, but I kind of want to add fermented Korean chili paste to it. I didn't do it to sort of force the issue. I just kind of thought, hey, this tastes good to me. And little by little, people also started thinking it was good too. So I just continued down that road. And so I've become this chef that has sort of incorporated, you know, a lot of different experiences from my history in my food. So I really, you know, tell people, like, I don't know what kind of cuisine I cook. I just cook the cuisine of my life, my history. You know, it's part Korean, it's part global, it's part Southern.
Now, I actually have been to South Korea. I lived there for about a month many, many years ago. When I came back to the United States and ate Korean food here, I noticed, wow, this isn't the same. Do you see similar, like, sort of interpretations of meals or food, whether it be Korean food or other types of food, that you think, what happened there? How did things get lost along the way?
Listen, there's no traditional Korean food in America because we're using American beef, and we're using American chili peppers, and we're using American products, and we're forced to sort of modify the food for a different audience. Authentic Korean food only exists in Korea. Once it winds up on these shores, people have to improvise. They get influenced by their neighbors. They might find that they like, American cheese on top of, you know, bulgogi. As any chef or any artist will tell you, like, food is not static. It doesn't, you know, belong in a mausoleum. It transforms, it evolves. It always is making, you know, modifications. And that's what happens. That's the great thing that happens when food comes to this country. It just grows and evolves. And eventually, it ends up looking very different from the food of the homeland. And I always say, like, when I think about American food, I just think about anyone who's ever come to this country and cooked and couldn't find an ingredient and improvised with something else is cooking American food, but looking at it through a foreign lens, right? So you're cooking American food, but with a Korean lens, or you're cooking a food that's American, but with an Italian lens or a French lens or a Nigerian lens. You know, all we do is to struggle to preserve something of the cuisine of our homeland, while at the same time we're trying to assimilate with what's happening in this country. And that's an experience that is very unique to this country.
I also find it interesting that sometimes the food is accepted before the people, if you will, are accepted. Mexican food, if you will, has sort of become part of the quote-unquote American food culture, right? Tacos mm-hmm. everywhere, mm-hmm. taco trucks. and yet we have this cognitive dissonance, I think, between our love for all food Mexican and this bizarre tension with people who are of Mexican descent or who are immigrants?
Oh, 100%. What I've always found interesting is that when we write about high-end cuisine, we speak about the chefs in very human terms. They're very glowing, they're very warm, very personal writing. And when we talk about tacos or pho or, you know, falafels, we generally find a list where it's like the 10 best tacos you can find for under $5. And we never talk about the people that are actually cooking those tacos, even though there is a human being cooking those tacos. And so part of my thing with the book was that I wanted to see if there were stories out there. I wanted to find the actual people that cooked these humble foods that we all find that we love, but we never really want to get into the people that cook the food.
I'm wondering also about something that I see in New York a lot, and I'm sure you see it around the country, is also the gentrification of food, is what I'm calling it. And mm-hmm. what I mean by that is taking, you know, a taco or a food item that is from a community that is not yours, essentially, and repurposing it, maybe making it more glam, usually means making it smaller and more expensive. What are your thoughts on that?
Food has always been appropriated. Food has always been, and you know, shared and stolen and intermixed. This is part of the history of cuisine. There's no cuisine that has existed in isolation. So when we gentrify food, yeah, it's an art. We are elevating it into an art form. It happens with any elevated art form. People have been complaining or lauding this about music for time beginning. I do believe there's room for both. What happens is as we gentrify food, as we take it out of its original context and make it pretty, it becomes that much more important to actually go back and look at the history of that food.
Edward Lee is the author of Buttermilk Graffiti, A Chef's Journey to Discover America's New Melting Pot Cuisine. Edward, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And you can find some of the recipes featured in Edward Lee's book, along with all of this week's food coverage, at thetakeaway.org/American food. And we want to know, what's your relationship with food like?
This is Jessie calling from Philadelphia. I'm from Peru, and there are a few Peruvian restaurants here in most of the U.S., but there are some popping up, thankfully, in big cities. And some of those big cities, though, because Americans still find Peruvian food a bit foreign, are including more familiar items from other Latin American countries.
My name is Barry. I'm calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota. My family comes from Eastern European Jewish background. My childhood was filled with blintzes, kasha varnishkas, lox cream cheese and bagels, latkes. As an adult, I eat a lot of food from around the world, Asian, Indian, East African, Mexican food are a regular part of my diet.
This is Andrea, and I'm calling from Elkins Park, Pennsylvania. And cooking has become a creative outlet in a structured life for me. Not that dinner time isn't dinner time, but I can freestyle more at the stove than I can at my desk.
Hi, this is Doris from St. Augustine, Florida.
Our cooked meals are usually chicken or steak on the grill, potatoes or rice in the microwave, and salad from a bag. I wish I were more adventurous, but we're both basic eaters, and I think that's kind of the extent of my talent.
Tomorrow, we'll talk more about food gentrification and how that's playing out in the United States. Join the conversation at the Takeaway's Facebook page. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.